Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai, Ananta Krishna Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai, Namacharya Srila Haridasa Thakur Ki Jai, Brahma Shikha Hoshi Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Adwaita Gadad Harshi Vasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai, Shri Radha Krishna Gogopinath Shri Mukunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhana Ki Jai, Vrindavan Dhamma Ki Jai, Maturisa Ki Jai, Navadvip Mayapur Dhamma Ki Jai, Jagannath Puri Dhamma Ki Jai, Dangamaya Jumuni Devi Ki Jai, Bhakti Devi Ki Jai, Tulsi Mahani Ki Jai, Samaveta Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai, Gaurakananda. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Sri Prabhupada. Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasaya Bhutale. Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Nityananda. Namaste Saraswati Deva Gauravani Pacharana. Nirvasesa Sumavadi Paskatyadi Satarana. Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yutama Parakamalam Sri Guru and Vaishnavascha. Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Ravanatam Vitam Sam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvaditam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Deva. Radha Krishna Param Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Vitamstra. Panchakalpa Chupascha Kupasana Vieva Tapati Panam Pavanevi O Vaishnava Devi O Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So it's December 8th, 2021, class in Hilo, Hawaii, over the internet, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 29, Text 32. This is talks between Narada and King Puchinibari. This is when Narada is explaining his allegory. Dukeshve Kantarenapi. Daiva Bhutatma Hetushu. Divasyana Vyavachcheda. Sakchet Tatat Pratikriya. Dukeshu. Okay. Go ahead.
Dukeshu.
In the matter of distresses, Ekatarena, from one kind, Api, even, Daiva, Providence, Bhuta, other living entities, Atma, the body and mind. Heteshu. On account of. Jivasya. Of the living entity. Na. Never. Vyavachedaha. Stopping. Syat is possible. Chet, although. Tut tut of those miseries. Pratikriya, counteraction. Srila Prabhupada's translation. The living entities are trying to counteract different miserable conditions pertaining to providence, other living entities, or the body and mind. Still, they must remain conditioned by the laws of nature, despite all attempts to counter these laws. Srila Prabhupada's purport. Just as a dog wanders here and there for a piece of bread or punishment, The living entity perpetually wanders about, trying to be happy and planning in so many ways to counteract material misery. This is called the struggle for existence. We can actually see in our daily lives how we are forced to make plans to drive away miserable conditions. To get rid of one miserable condition, we have to put ourselves in another kind of miserable condition. A poor man suffers for want of money, but if he wants to become rich, he has to struggle in so many ways. Actually, that is not a valid counteracting process, but a snare of the illusory energy. If one does not endeavor to counteract his situation, but is satisfied with his position, knowing that he has obtained his position through past activities, he can instead engage his energy to develop Krishna consciousness. This is recommended in all Vedic literatures. Tasyaiva heto pratateta kovido na labdhate yad brahmatam uparyada tad labhyate dukhavad anyata sukham kalena sarvatra gavira ramhasa. Persons who are actually intelligent and philosophically inclined should endeavor only for that purposeful end, which is not obtainable even by wandering from the topmost planet Brahmaloka down to the lowest planet Patala. As far as happiness derived from sense enjoyment is concerned, it can be obtained automatically in course of time, just as in course of time we obtain miseries even though we do not desire them. Srimad Bhagavatam 1.5.18. One should simply try to develop his Krishna consciousness and not waste his time trying to improve his material condition. Actually, the material condition cannot be improved. The process of improvement means accepting another material condition. However, if we endeavor to improve our Krishna consciousness, the distresses of material life will disappear without extraneous endeavor. However, if we endeavor to improve our Krishna consciousness, the distresses of material life will disappear without extraneous endeavor. Now, what does that mean? Krishna therefore promises, Kunteya Pratijanihi ye na me bhaktya pranashyati, O son of Kunti, declared boldly that my devotee never perishes, Bhagavad Gita 9.31. One who takes to the path of devotional service will never be vanquished despite... One who takes the path of devotional service will never be vanquished despite all miseries of the body and mind and despite all misery brought about by other living entities and providence, miseries which are beyond our control. So, fascinating concept. Dukesh vekatarena pi daiva bhutat mahetushu jivasya na vyavachcheda syachetat pratikriya. The living entities are trying to counteract different miserable conditions pertaining to providence, other living entities, or the body and mind. Still, they must remain conditioned by the laws of nature despite all attempts to counter these laws. Pratikriya. Kriya means action. Prati means other, going against. So counteractions. So Srila Prabhupada is making some very astonishing statements here. Material condition cannot be improved. The process of improvement means accepting another miserable condition. However, if we endeavor to improve our Krishna consciousness, the distresses of material life will disappear without extraneous endeavor. And then he says that one who takes the process of devotional service will not be vanquished despite all these miseries of Adiyatmak, Adidaivak, and Adibhautik. So we want to be happy. We don't want to be miserable. Nobody wants to be miserable. I mean, even people who apparently want to be miserable as a way of trying to be happy. People who get into, you know, being a victim and always lamenting, and anger, and those are other rasas. Prabhupada says, I talk about this all the time, how in the preface of Nectar Devotion, he says that everything we do is motivated by the desire to enjoy rasa. So even if a person is apparently enjoying miseries, sadness, grief is one of the rasas. Anger is one of the rasas. Horror is one of the rasas. Fear is one of the rasas. So even if a person is apparently very much fearful and angry and horrified and lamenting, it's still an attempt to be happy. Because Ananda Maya Vyasat, we want to be happy. Nobody wants to be miserable. I mean, what I've read is that, you know, people who self-harm, who like cut themselves, they do that because there's a sense of some, I've never tried it, hopefully I never will, but some sense of euphoria that occurs. Or people who take, you know, various intoxicants that damage their health. Why do they do it? They're trying for some happiness. So everything everyone is doing, the scientists call this the pleasure principle, that everything everyone is doing is to try to be happy. Yes? But in this material world, how is that possible? It's not possible to be happy. It's just not possible. Because we have birth, death, old age, and disease. We have miseries of the body, miseries of the mind, miseries from other living entities, and miseries from material nature. And in Kali Yuga, Prabhupada says elsewhere, we're always getting at least one of them. One of the first things we learn when we come to Krishna consciousness is that where our nature is to be happy, in material life, one cannot be happy. So we're going to look at this from the body, mind, and soul. Because naturally we want to be happy and we want to pratikriya. We want to take actions against misery. Dukeshu. We want to take actions against misery. And we want to establish our happiness. This is natural. It's not unnatural. It's part of our spiritual nature. All right, let's look at this first on the platform of the body, on the platform of gross matter. So, on the platform of gross matter, our miseries seem very concrete and objective, right? You know, I bumped my, like, okay, just recently I was visiting my kids, and I was doing some, messing with something in the closet, and I pinched my finger, and when I pinched my finger, it was bleeding under the skin, so there was like a little lump under the skin. And then it bruised, and so there was some pain. So you could say, that's an objective, concrete thing. You know, you pinch your finger, it gets bruised, and it hurts. It's objective. Or we could say, misery from other living entities is objective. Somebody cuts ahead of me in line, or they steal something from me, or, you know, whatever. It's something objective. You could even go to court and you could prove that somebody stole something from you, or you could prove that somebody cheated in their contract. It's something objective. Or today where I am, it's rainy and cold. And the weather is objectively unpleasant. You have to dress warmly, you have to dress so that you'll stay dry. So it's objective. Or we haven't eaten for a long time, we're hungry, we haven't drunk, we're thirsty, and there's some distress in the body. Or we're very tired, there's a distress in the mind also when we're tired. So we can say that there's objective. And if they're objective and they're concrete, then there should be an objective, concrete way of counteracting them. Right? It's cold and rainy, you wear a warm raincoat. You're hungry, you eat. Somebody steals from you, you take them, you file a police report, and they get convicted and they get fined. And, right? Somebody cheats you and you report it. And so there's a concrete, objective way to counteract it. And it may appear that Srila Prabhupada's saying in this purport that we should never do that. Because he's saying one should simply try to develop his Krishna consciousness and not waste his time trying to improve his material condition. Actually, the material condition cannot be improved. So we might think, well, if I break my arm, I just let it be broken. that's not what Prabhupada means. That if you break your arm, you should indeed go to the doctor and have it put in a cast. When I was visiting my family, one of the grandchildren was playing with a stick, a dirty stick, and it poked his foot, and his foot became swollen and infected. And he was 9 years old, and for the first time in his life, he was taking antibiotics, which, you know, say antibiotics have their own problems. But you know, if he wants to keep his foot. I was reading the history of the development of the first antibiotics, the first sulfa drugs, and how people used to die from getting pricked by a thorn on a rose bush. You know, so it's not that we don't take any counteracting measures. Srila Prabhupada would adjust his diet. Prabhupada would take medicine, usually Ayurvedic medicine. Prabhupada started taking walks and getting massages because he had a stroke. So it's not that we don't take any counteracting measures. And I say frequently in my classes that sometimes just moving a piece of furniture around can make a huge difference in the functionality of our life. I've experienced that myself. You move a chair to the other side of the room, and I'm like, wow, all of a sudden things are really improved. So that's there. However, we run into a problem with counteracting measures on the objective, concrete, gross platform. And that is that our counteracting measures also involve certain sorts of distresses. You know, we have to go to the doctor, we have to take the medicine, the medicine may have some unwanted side effect on us, you know, it may upset our body in another way. You know, there's some trouble we have to take, even if I'm moving some furniture, there's some trouble I have to take to counteract the trouble. I have to take trouble to counteract the trouble. And so on the objective, concrete platform, everything is always ends up in balance. There's never a net gain. Like Prabhupada says, if a person's poor, they can counteract their poverty. Though the poverty is miserable, and then their working hard is also a kind of misery. You know, if we're in the law of karma, it's like that. Whatever we do, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Whatever we enjoy, we've had to pay for it. You can't steal anything in the universe. And just like even in ordinary life, right? If I go to the store, I buy a sweater for $20. So I had to undergo some difficulty for that $20, right? I had to earn it in some way. Maybe I inherited it from my parents, but then I had to be an obedient child. Right? Maybe someone gave it to me as a gift, but then I had to work on relationships where people want to give me gifts. And maybe I earned it. Maybe that $20 represents, you know, an hour or 2 hours worth of work. So, you know, the thing that I've purchased, I get this sweater that I've purchased, but I had to put in a commensurate amount of trouble in order to get that. Now, let's say I say, well, I'm not going to go through some trouble. I'm just going to steal it. I'm just going to steal the sweater. Of course, I also have to go through some trouble to steal the sweater. Thieves also often work very, very hard. It's not that they don't work hard. It's not that there's no endeavor. So let's say I go through some trouble and have some anxiety, right? If I'm going to steal the sweater, how am I going to do it without getting caught and so forth? I have to hatch a whole plan and then I have to be in anxiety about it. And then, if I am caught, or let's say when I'm caught, so I may have to pay a fine that's far more than the $20. I might have to pay a $200 fine, plus I might have to pay $50 in court costs, or I may have to go to jail. I'm sure for a $20 sweater, I wouldn't spend much time in jail, but even if I spent a few days in jail. So that would be a lot more trouble than whatever I would have gone through to earn the $20. So the law of karma works very much like that. So if I've given in charity and I've spent my money honestly, if I've earned money honestly, spent it honestly, and given in charity, then I get more money as a result of that good karma. I may get more money in this life or I might get more money in another life. However, if I get money dishonestly, I don't give in charity and so much, then I have to, in a sense, pay interest. So I have to suffer more than I would have suffered by earning it honestly, because then I've caused pain to others in the process. Right? If I earn money dishonestly, I've caused pain. That's the idea of stealing. I've caused pain. And so then I not only have to pay what I would have paid otherwise, but I have to pay extra for the pain that I've caused. And this is true when we're trying to do good or ill to others. I cannot do karmically good to others other than what they have earned karmically. It's like the, you know, UPS, FedEx, DHL, these courier companies. They can only deliver to you what you've ordered and paid for. They can't deliver to you something that you haven't paid for. So I don't have the capacity karmically to help somebody in a way that they don't karmically deserve. I mean, it would have to be that way because I can't hurt somebody in a way that they don't karmically deserve either. You know, if somebody wants to steal something or murder somebody, they can only steal something from someone who deserves to have that lost, or murder someone who deserves to die. So it becomes a net balance. Everything balances out, and there's no net gain. There's no net loss, but there's no net gain. You end up nowhere. So when we make external adjustments, external concrete objective adjustments to what appear to be external objective concrete miseries, we end up at zero. It's a what they call mathematics, a zero-sum game. And we think we're getting ahead, and we think we're making advancement. We think we're helping others. But we're not, really. It's an illusion. And it gets very frustrating. It really does, this trying to take care of seemingly objective, concrete miseries with objective, concrete counteractions. But this concept persists in us. We're really invested in this idea that miseries and happiness are concrete and objective and outside of us, and that by manipulating the material energy, we'll overcome them. It just doesn't work. So a person who understands this comes to the platform of the mind and decides that on the platform of the mind, all misery is subjective. And this view is very much upheld by Shastra. The Avanti Brahmana says this in the 11th canto. He says, actually, all my happiness and misery is in the mind. And Srila Prabhupada, something that really revolutionized my life, my personal life, is the statement Srila Prabhupada makes in a class he gave on the teachings of Lord Kapila. It's written up in the book Teachings of Lord Kapila on page 100 and something, where he says that anyone may situate his mind in such a way that he's not disturbed even by the pain of a surgical operation. And he gave the example of Stalin, who was afraid that he would be murdered if he went under anesthesia. So he had an operation without anesthesia and didn't feel any pain. That's fascinating, isn't it? It's fascinating that pain and suffering are not objective and concrete. They are fully subjective. They are an interpretation by the mind. And modern medicine is accepting this. So modern medicine is accepting that all pain, they will say all pain is an opinion of the brain. That our brain or our mind, however you want to look at it, it decides whether or not a particular event is painful or not. Now, this is true when it comes to the body, even, and something that is apparently very objective. So there's, you can find the video about this. A scientist, Latimer, talks about how he was walking in the forest in Australia, what they call the bush, and he felt something brush up against his left leg, and he thought, oh, it was a twig. And he didn't pay much attention to it. It wasn't painful. Soon after that, he went into convulsions and almost died. He had evidently gotten bitten by a poisonous snake. And, you know, he recovered and so forth. And then later again, he was walking through the forest, through the bush, and he felt a similar sensation on his leg. And at that time, he was writhing in agony and in great pain, although this time it was just a twig. So when his mind thought that the sensation was a twig, even though it was a snake, he didn't feel pain. And when his mind thought it was a snake, although it was a twig, he did feel pain. And there's a lot of evidence of soldiers who get severely injured and don't feel any pain because they're focused on what they're doing. And I myself have personally experienced that I can adjust my mind so that I do not feel physical pain. And I have experienced this thousands and thousands of times. So this is true even when it's something that is objective. The pain is useful as an alarm system, but your brain decides whether or not it's actually painful, whether or not we're going to label it as painful. And such is also certainly true when it comes to emotional and psychological pain. What story do we tell about it? You know, we put ourselves through a lot of pain by interpreting what happens to us as an affront by interpreting it as an insult, by deciding that the actions or the words of other living beings are offensive to us, and we cause ourselves pain. Whereas we could tell another story, and we all had so many examples of this. I just went through this with somebody where I was visiting them, and they said, "Why are you leaving your stuff here?" And I said, "It's actually not my stuff, it's your stuff." I said, "You know, it's not mine." And when I was leaving, I put a little sign on it, and I said, this is your stuff." And the person said, "Why are you labeling it like that? Are you telling me what to do with the things in my house?" And I said, "No, I was trying to communicate that it's not my stuff, and I wouldn't be leaving my stuff in your house." And so they were interpreting it that I was insulting them, and I said, "No, I was actually trying to be respectful." So we all have instances like this, where we do or say something out of love and respect, and another person interprets that very thing to be disrespectful. And it comes to us too, that we interpret someone's behavior as disrespectful or as offensive, when the person intended no offense. In fact, they might have intended to be loving. So, you know, what story do we tell about the facts? The example that I've given many times was a man who went to a restaurant, and the waitress got his order wrong and spilled some water and so forth. And he was very upset, and he was deciding, "I'm not going to leave much of a tip." And then he overheard some of the other wait staff talking about his waitress and saying, "Wow, you know, her husband died only 5 days ago, and she's left with several children at home. I'm amazed that she's coming to work. Well, she must really need the money." And once the customer understood that the waitress had been forgetful and spilling things because she was grieving her husband, then he no longer interpreted her behavior as offensive to him. He reinterpreted her behavior. He told a different story, and he left a very big tip. So the mind is the source, how we interpret our life. You know, and it can be even on a very, very simple, a very simple thing. Like, "Oh man, you know, like where I stay, the way the door is, and the configuration of the room where I'm staying, a lot of dirt and leaves come into my room. It's almost impossible. I'd say it's impossible to keep them out. The autumn leaves collect outside my door, and there's like a corner there, and as soon as you open the door, they come in. And, you know, so I constantly have debris from the outside on the floor, and it's a white floor, so it really shows. So I could consider this a misery. You know, "Oh, I have to sweep my floor all the time. I have to clean up my floor all the time. Oh, this is miserable." Or I could consider it a benediction. "Wow, I live in the country. How wonderful that I live in the country, where there's leaves and there's dirt, that I'm not living in the city. How wonderful that I have a broom. How wonderful that my arms and legs work and I can use a broom. How wonderful that I have a facility to keep my room clean. That I have the, you know, many people my age are not capable anymore of sweeping their floor." So I could see it as a wonderful thing. It's wonderful to live in the country. It's wonderful to be able to clean. It's wonderful to clean for Krishna. Or I could see it as a misery. "Oh, I mean, all these leaves and debris is always coming into my room." So this is true with everything. Every single thing in life we can see with irritation, or we can see with gratitude. Everything. You know, there's a famous example of St. Francis of Assisi, that he says, "The greatest joy would be if I would go to a monastery in the freezing rain, and even though the person at the door would recognize me as one of the monks, that they would say that they didn't recognize me and leave me out in the cold, and if I would feel joyful. That would be the greatest happiness, if I could feel joy even at a very difficult situation." So, you know, miseries can be then seen in the mind, and the counteracting measure can be that we change our mental sense. We change how we view it. Now, even this is not really getting rid of miseries, because the trouble one has to take mentally is equal to the misery. In other words, if one wants to cultivate, as they say, an attitude of gratitude, and if one wants to cultivate seeing everything as a blessing, and if one wants to cultivate seeing the good in things, that also takes work. It takes effort. There's some difficulty in it. I mean, it comes more and more naturally as one does it, but it definitely is work. And it's sometimes not easy. There are things which really challenge our ability to see things as blessings and really challenge our ability to find the good in everything and to reinterpret everything as good. And that effort is equal to the misery that we're, again, just like on the material level, that effort in the mind is equal to the misery that we're counteracting, and we end up with a net balance of zero. Of course, it's much better to live in sattva-gun than in rajagun and tamagun, and being grateful and choosing to find the good in things is a lot nicer way. It's sattva-gun. In rajagun, you see much more. You get proud of your suffering. You brag about your suffering. And in tamagun, you're always kvetching and moaning and complaining about your suffering. So better to be in sattva-gun than in tamagun. But really, it's all wet stool, dry stool. So let's go to the spiritual platform. Now, interestingly, on the spiritual platform, one can get a net gain. One can get a net gain without paying for it. This is what we call causeless mercy. And we might say, well, we pay for it with our sadhana and our austerity. But not really. Our sadhana and our austerity are just to make us receptive to the spiritual. And whatever we may so-called pay is nothing compared to the unlimited spiritual realization and happiness that we achieve. It's not commensurate as it is on the platform of the body and the mind. And it's not really counteracting the misery. It's transcending it. It's on the body, your body on the gross objective level, one is trying to counter the misery. On the mental level, one is trying to counter the misery. Although ironically, the way one counters the misery on the mental level is to stop resisting the misery and to stop labeling it as misery. But on the spiritual level, we're not really counteracting it. We're transcending it. We're rising above it, like an airplane going above a storm. I was recently on an airplane, and they said, the captain gets on and says, there's turbulence at all altitudes. We cannot go above or below the turbulence. So you'll just have to fasten your seatbelts and stay in your seats. But spiritually, you can always go above. The airplane can't go above. You have to be in a rocket ship to go above. But spiritually, you can go above. And therefore, in spiritual life, Prabhupada says these things that seem to be contradictory here. He says that if we endeavor to improve our Krishna consciousness, the distresses of material life will disappear without extraneous endeavor. So we won't have to endeavor to do a gross or a subtle counteraction. They simply disappear. They become like fog in the sunlight. They go away. But then Prabhupada also says that if we take to the path of devotional service, we won't be vanquished despite these adhyatmic, adhidaimic, and adhibhautic miseries. So the first statement sounds like we simply don't have miseries. We just won't break our arm and nobody will insult us and it will never be cold and rainy and the leaves won't blow onto our nice, clean, white floor. That's what it sounds like. But then Prabhupada is saying we will be happy even though we break our arm and even though it's cold and rainy and even though people insult us and even though the leaves blow onto our clean, white floor. That even though those things are happening, we will still be happy. So how do we adjust these two, and what does it mean? So what it means is, yes, as long as we are in a physical body, in the material world, geographically speaking, these things will happen. It's not that for pure devotees that dirt doesn't blow on their floor. And it's not that pure devotees don't get insulted, or attempts even made to kill them, like with Prahlad and Haridas. Bhakti Sananta Sarasvati, there were people who wanted to kill him. So these things are going to happen. They're not going to go away. It's not that if you're in the material world chanting Hare Krishna, the sun's always going to shine on you and it's never going to rain. That wouldn't be good anyway. You have to have some rain. But that's not the reality. There are going to be storms. There are going to be wars. There is going to be dirt. There are going to be nasty people who insult you. You will get your foot infected. I mean, this stuff is going to still happen. But the misery connected with it will be gone. Without having to counteract that misery in any way, it will just be gone. And the pure devotee may take, in some situations, counteracting measures. As we were saying, Prabhupada got a massage every day and went for a walk every day. He would take Ayurvedic medicine. If you're a pure devotee, you're still going to put a bandage on a bleeding cut. You may still take antibiotics for an infection. You may still get a surgical operation. You may move your furniture around. You may talk to someone who's offended you. We may still do those sort of things as if we were a materialist trying to counteract them, but we will do them as a service. This body belongs to Krishna, and I will take care of it just like I will change the oil in a car. You know, the Maya of the renunciates is the car doesn't belong to anybody, so I won't take care of it. And the Maya of those who are not renunciates is the car belongs to me, therefore I will take care of it. So we should take care of this body, not because it belongs to me and is the source of my happiness, but because it belongs to Krishna. It's his body. And I will take care of the mind because it belongs to Krishna. Krishna would like me to be grateful. That's one of the 14 items of knowledge. Krishna would like me to be kind. Krishna says one who is a kind friend to all living entities is very dear to me. Krishna says this. I quote often Bhagavad Gita 2:64, where Krishna says one who's free from all attachment and aversion and who regulates the senses will get the mercy of the Lord. So Krishna wants us to put our mind in a state free of attachment and aversion, which is a counteracting force for misery. Krishna wants us to regulate the senses, which is a counteracting force for misery, but to please him, not to counteract the miseries. And then he will give us his mercy. So we do that as a service to Krishna, not to try to be happy in this world. And how do we try to become happy? Because Anandamaya Vyasat, we are happiness seekers. And Prabhupada talks about our real self-interest. We try to become happy by pleasing Krishna. Not to please Krishna to make us happy. Not that we're using Krishna. You know, in this world, I may try to please someone because I think there's something they can give me. I don't really care whether they're pleased or not. I'm just hoping if they're pleased, they'll give me something. So not to please Krishna like that. Well, if I please Krishna, he'll give me ecstasy. But to please Krishna just because it's wonderful to please Krishna. We all experience that on the material level. Right? That we do things for people just to make them smile. We're not trying to get anything from them. We certainly experience that. The joy of helping others just to help others. So when we become absorbed in that, the happiness of that, of giving of love, like Krishna tells the gopis, let your own love be your compensation. The happiness of being filled with this altruistic love for Krishna is so great that we don't really notice the material miseries. We may notice that something needs to be adjusted in service. I mean, if we're really absorbed, we don't even notice that. But if we may notice that. We may notice, oh, for my service to Krishna, I have to do this thing for the body, I have to do this thing for the mind, to please Krishna. It becomes part of our pleasing Krishna. We lose all awareness of material miseries as miseries. And this is because we become absorbed in bhakti. You know, just those who stay on the mind are on the platform of jnana and vairagya. If I put the mind in a position of knowledge and detachment, I'm free from miseries. But if that's all one does, then one is still in this counteracting process. However, when we become absorbed in Krishna, jnana and vairagya follow. They're included. When I become absorbed in trying to please Krishna, and I become absorbed in the desires and the emotions of the relationship with Krishna, then naturally I have jnana and vairagya of the mind. And naturally, I have Jnana and Vairagya of the body and the externals. And therefore, Prabhupada says in Krishna Book Chapter 20 that for the materialist, the world appears very aggressive, but to the devotee, everything is happily situated. A pure devotee simply does not see the world as an aggressive place. Now, a person may say, well, I can't do that now because I'm not a pure devotee. But practicing this is our process of bhakti yoga. It's not that we just act like a gross or subtle materialist until we become a pure devotee. We practice acting as a devotee. That's what sadhana bhakti means. Sadhana bhakti means I practice being a devotee. I practice being a devotee on the gross level, on the subtle level, and on the spiritual level. And so, even for a beginner, actually, kleshagni, destruction of difficulties, as one of the symptoms of bhakti yoga, is on the platform of sadhana bhakti. Right? Rupa Goswami gives 6 symptoms of pure devotional service. One of them, kleshagni, getting rid of the difficulties of life. That is there at the beginning, in sadhana bhakti. So if we're frequently absorbed in the miseries of life, we're frequently feeling the miseries of life, that's a sign that there's something not quite what it should be with our sadhana. You know, if we're frequently telling stories of our victimization and how this person has hurt us and that person has hurt us, you know, or the government's doing this, or these, if we're frequently doing that, or we're frequently absorbed in our body pain, then we can understand my sadhana is not really on the platform of bhakti. Maybe it's just, you know, I'm doing my sadhana mechanically or something like that, which puts it on the platform of Bhagavad Gita 12.10, Krishna Karmani. I'm doing some work for Krishna, and that it won't have that effect. It won't have the effect of taking us beyond miseries. But when we're absorbed in Krishna, we really will have this kleshagni. Now, we might not have it, we probably won't have it 100% or 100% all the time while we're just in sadhana bhakti, but at least we will be experiencing it regularly and seeing that it is true and seeing that it is real. This is one of our tests. We talk about, you know, a test of advancement is detachment. Detachment doesn't just mean, you know, you don't have very many shoes or something like that. Detachment means that you're not very affected by the pains and pleasures of the world without having to engage in a lot of counteracting measures, either physically or mentally. That your absorption in Krishna consciousness is such that the miseries of the world, you may, again, notice that something needs some attention. You may notice the car needs gas, the body needs food. But one is in a state of joyfulness. So questions, comments, additions, subtractions, corrections.
Just a moment. Thank you for your very thought-provoking class. I'm referring to something that you said about this, if I got it correctly, this material world is a zero-sum game.
Good.
It seems like an exception to this, although there really can't be any exceptions, is the, at least in my, by my way, anyway, the punishments we read in the fifth canto. What in Vedic society is known as illicit sex, today may be called consensual sex, but there's horrendous punishment for that, those kinds of activities when ostensibly, externally, no one has really been hurt. Can you comment on that, please? Do you agree with me, or do you see what I'm saying?
I don't agree with you. Is that all right? Can I not agree with you?
Absolutely.
All right. I'm absolutely allowed not to agree with you. I was actually recently criticized for encouraging people to not have illicit sex, believe it or not. I was recently quite severely criticized that why aren't you encouraging people to divorce and remarry? And sociologically speaking, dharmic sex is not just about consent. In fact, it's funny you bring this up because I was thinking about this early this morning, that in all human societies that I'm aware of, and maybe some exceptions, previous to World War II, the concept of consent as the main measure of dharma was not there. Because marriages were arranged by parents for both men and women. You know, it wasn't about consent. The marriage was arranged. It was arranged at a young age. And that was kind of like whether you liked it or not. People were married when they were teenagers by the arrangement of their family and society. Yes? Am I correct?
So far, sure.
Yeah, and you were expected to stay in that marriage lifelong. That was it. You know, that was it for you. Unless your spouse died. You know, or unless there was something really severe. And if there was something really severe, you were generally expected not to remarry. You could separate. You know, so if your spouse was beating you or, you know, crazy or something like that, you know, you could separate. But you didn't marry again. The only marriage again was the death of the spouse. And in many societies, death of the husband, the woman would not remarry. Only a man would remarry for death of the spouse. So in our modern society, you can have sex with anyone as long as they're an adult and they agree. That's our modern dharma. You have to be an adult and you have to agree. Of course, people who are not legal adults are still having sex. You know, and in most places, that's fine as long as you don't get married, which is really peculiar. You know, so we have all these laws now that you can have sex before you're 18, you're just not allowed to get married. That's the modern law. But what does this cause in society? You say it's not harming anyone. I'd say it's harming everyone. I'd say our modern society, where anybody can have sex with anybody, as long as they all agree, has caused extreme social disruption. It's caused extreme emotional distress to a large portion of the world's population. It's caused extreme emotional stress to the children that are produced. It's caused extreme emotional stress to people who form relationships, then break them, then form them again, then break them. The physiology, the chemical nature of sex is that it's binding. The sexual act releases chemicals in the body that cause attachment and that cause trust and that cause a feeling of affection by the design of God. So human children who have a very long childhood so that they can be trained in spiritual life will have a stable situation. That's why Krishna's arranged that. And you mess that up and you mess up everything. You know, also the majority of crime, statistically, the majority of crime is done by whom? Men or women?
Oh, probably men.
Men. What age?
Well, 18 to 35, I would guess.
Yes. Yes. And this is true across all cultures. What helps is if the man is married. A married man is much less likely to be a criminal. Girlfriends don't do it. Only a wife does it. Or a fiancé. This is just a statistical fact. So the fact that people can engage in, you know, consensual sex with any adult has caused a huge increase in crime in the world. Also, accidents. Who's most likely to get into an accident? Again, men between the age of like 18 and 25. Single men. So a society where sex is not regulated in a proper way causes social disruption, crime, accidents, what to speak of diseases. How many sexual diseases are there? Sexually transmitted diseases. Depression. I mean, so many of the psychological problems people are having is due to illicit sex and breakup of relationships. I mean, the harm that's done is incredible. And it's a harm that's done to oneself. It's a harm that's done to one's partner or partners. It's a harm that's done to the children and to the whole society. Has huge, huge suffering. Unbelievable suffering. And, you know, everything becomes chaotic. Spiritually, it's very hard for spiritual life when people's lives are so messed up. And it's certainly very difficult for material life. You know, proper sexual morality, I mean, sex and money are the two things that, when done dishonestly, disrupt all of society, and when done honestly, cause peace in society. I've sometimes asked when I give class, let's just say that we woke up tomorrow and every romantically involved couple in the world was kind and loving to each other. Let's say that was the only thing that changed in the world, nothing else. Would that affect all of society? What would you say?
I would say deeply. Yeah.
Very deeply. So, yeah, I'm sure you know that half of all murders are between romantic partners. So I would say it's a huge thing. And the punishment given is commensurate with the harm. People think they're not harming anyone. They think, oh, it's just my business. You know, who I have sex with, how many people I have sex with, you know, it's just my personal business. It's no one else's business. But that's not really true. I mean, of course, now in 2021, if we don't behave like that, we won't be able to function in society. You know, there's no way I could function in 2021 in society except by saying what anyone does with their sexual life is not my business. I have to go along with that flow of the river of the society, or I would not be able to function in society. But actually, it is everybody's business. And that's why, you know, it wasn't that long ago, 60, 70 years ago, that people were very concerned. You know, there was a concern to get people married at a young age to a suitable person. People were concerned to help marriages stay together. They were concerned to make sure that the children were raised properly. It was considered a concern of the whole society. And there were heavy stigmas attached to illegitimate children. They couldn't inherit property. I mean, often they were cut out of many privileges of society. So it was a concern of society. So, you know, we can't talk about this very much. I mean, here I'm talking about it in this class and it's being recorded, but we really can't talk about this very much. As I say, in 2021, it's such an unpopular stance, and there's such a heavy emotional visceral reaction to this kind of thing that we just have to throw up our hands and say, just chant Hare Krishna. Just whatever you're doing, just chant Hare Krishna. Let me look in the chat. We have a couple things from Kandita. It's amazing to me that you've experienced what other people would definitely say causes them severe pain. You've managed to not feel it at all. Well, I feel it. I just don't experience it as pain. Let's say you're getting a root canal so you don't feel anything. Well, you feel something, but you don't tag it as pain. How are you able to do that? All pain in the mind is caused from fear and attention. If you have no fear of it and you don't pay it attention, then you know that there's a sensation there, but you don't experience it as pain. That's the essence of it. You get rid of the fear and attention. Okay, from Ramananda, many people see spiritualists as fatalistic and lazy because renunciates priests there's a need to endeavor to avoid miseries. Such person think this mentality creates parasitic beggars living at the cost of hardworking, responsible members of society. What is a simple way to explain this to ordinary people with this complaint? The devotees generally, with exceptions, generally work just as hard in the world, but not to counteract miseries. They work hard in the world to serve the Lord, to please the Lord. They're not feeling the material miseries. They're not trying to counteract miseries. His answer to this was, you have not seen the Vaishnava. You have had, what about Arjuna? What about Hanuman? That was Prabhupada's answer to this. Now, there are devotees who do renounce the world and live on gifts and charity from the world. There are. And Prabhupada says that if one is living like that, one should be extremely careful how one spends one's money and how one lives, because one should not live at the cost of others. And one who lives like that should be making a strong contribution to the world spiritually. So somebody who's renounced the world and renounced the attempt to work in the world, even for the service of the Lord, which is what is supposed to happen in Vanaprastha and Sannyas, that you stop working in the world even for the service of the Lord. But one should dedicate one's time to the benefit of society. So the devotional renunciate is working just as hard, or sometimes harder, than the grihastha for the benefit of the world. And as I say, such a person should be very careful how they spend money received in charity. And as far as possible, money that they receive in charity, they should then redistribute also for the benefit of the world. Okay, we could maybe have one more question. Anybody else have any other questions or comments?
Thank you for such a wonderful class. It's very, I'm amazed.
Anyway, with the mind, it's very easy. It's really very easy. You put your attention to something else, and you simply tell yourself that the sensation you're feeling is safe. That's really all there is. It's really nothing else but that. I mean, people do a trick where they'll put their attention on the breath, or you can put your attention on your pulse, or you can put your attention on Krishna, for goodness sakes. And you tell yourself that this sensation that's happening in my body is safe. It's not dangerous. Now, let's say it actually is dangerous. Then, you know, you may have to put a Band-Aid on it or take some antibiotics. But once you've done that, once you've taken the antibiotics or once you've put on the Band-Aid, then it is no longer dangerous and there's no reason to have the alarm keep ringing. It really is that simple.
But I don't know if it's just the expectation of having a painful experience is really the cause of it. Because, you know, when I was a child and I went to the dentist for the first time, I wasn't expecting any pain. You know, I didn't know what to expect, but the dentist worked on me and then it just came anyway.
Yes, because the brain is interpreting that sensation as dangerous. Because it could be. Somebody drilling into your tooth could be dangerous. It could be. So it's completely legitimate. You know, see, our brain and our mind is mercifully arranged by the Lord to protect our body. Our brain is pre-programmed to be on the lookout for danger and to protect us from that danger. And one of the ways it protects us is by creating an idea of pain. That's one of the ways it protects us. It alerts us that this is dangerous. Otherwise, you know, I had a day once where I was packing and I cut my toe without realizing it because I was so absorbed in packing. And then people came to say goodbye and they said, "Why is there blood on the floor?" So I thought, oh my goodness, you know, it's a good thing you noticed it, because if I had gone out with a cut foot, it could have gotten infected. So, you know, it's a good thing that our brain sends an alarm of pain. But once then we look at it and we should say, is this dangerous? If it actually is dangerous, if we really do need to go see a doctor, or we really do need to get some medicine, we do that, but then we can turn off the alarm. It's just like if there's an alarm ringing because there's a fire, and you put out the fire and the alarm's still ringing, you can turn off the alarm. Or if the alarm's ringing just because you're making chapatis, you can turn off the alarm. So the fact that an alarm will go off, this happens even for the great souls. An alarm goes off, but then they decide, does this need attention or not? If it needs attention, they attend and turn off the alarm. If it doesn't need attention, they just turn off the alarm. Is a dentist drilling in your tooth actually dangerous? No, it's beneficial. So why do you need an alarm?
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Talking about it does.
Well, I will tell you that even complete materialist atheists can turn off pain by doing this. You don't even have to be a spiritual person. Just like you don't have to be a spiritual person to relieve an infection with antibiotics. You don't have to. I mean, Prabhupada gave the example of Stalin. He's not a spiritual person.
Right.
So if Stalin could turn off pain sensations by using his mind, then certainly spiritual people can do it.
Well, then there's the thing, too. I think some people have a very high pain threshold.
That's another thing. That's another thing. But regardless of that, all pain is in the mind. It's in the 11th canto. All.
Right.
100%. And this is a medically proven fact. All pain, whether physical or psychological, is due to the mind's interpreting whatever's happening as dangerous. All of it. None of it is objective. There is nothing that's objectively painful. It's all subjective. So again, some things, we're happy that our brain alerts us that there's a problem so that we can take care of it. But we want to take care of it for Krishna's service. The materialists want to take care of it so they can try to enjoy the world. But we don't need to go around feeling pain. It's not necessary. That's not how the system is designed. The system is designed for an alert. Hey, there's a problem over here, or there might be a problem over here. Maybe you want to check it out. Like that. All right, I need to get going.
Thank you.
I have to teach a class at the Gurukul in a little bit. Hare Krishna, Srila Prabhupada, Ki.
Thank you.